coming back, yeah. Said you boarded the night train. Lord, you know she ain't coming back, yeah.
Lucy Bluebird. Man, I got to tell you something. The band Rastus would open their shows with this song. This song was written by Bobby Jamison, and who else? Who was another writer on that? Do you remember?
Smokey may have been a writer on it.
Yeah. One hell of a song, and to open with this meant that the show could only get louder, faster, and have more energy, which is absolutely where this band was.
You know, I used to mix the show, and I could tell where the evening was going by the opening couple bars of this song, and it was pretty much a rule of mine. If it sounded great on the first couple bars,
yeah,
it's going to be a hell of a show because they found the groove right away.
Show would kick some butt, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was just amazing.
I remember that first note, na 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 na, and the hair would, like, people's hair would go flying straight back.
It was an attention getter.
Yeah, absolutely was. Now, at this point in time, the band had moved to a farmhouse in Chardon, Ohio, and the band had decided to live together so that they could rehearse together all the time and get to know one another and write songs together, yada, yada. And was a point where I had met a gentleman named Mr. Bobby Jamison out here in California and had become friends with him. Bobby was an excellent artist and one hell of a writer. And I decided to bring him back to the band because the band could use a good writer. And I figured he would fit in just fine with this group of gorillas, man, that call themselves Rastus. What do you think about that, Jim?
Well, I think Bobby was a great addition to the band. Even though he wasn't in the band, he came to live at the Rastus, the first Rastus house. And he was incredibly prolific. I mean, he would sit out in the woods. The house wasn't exactly a farm. The first house in Chardon, Ohio, it was a big, huge piece of property out in the country, and he would go sit out in the woods and with his briefcase and write songs. And as he says on his interview tape, get bit up by mosquitoes. And at that time, I was starting to write a little bit, and he started calling me Hemingway. So we had a little riff going at that time, but I looked up to him as a writer. I thought he was just one hell of a writer. He could sit and, you know, he had erratic habits. He would stay up all night sometimes, whether he was, you know, having fun or not, and he could stay up all night and write, and you'd wake up in the morning, come down to the kitchen to get a cup of coffee.
And there he was.
Yeah, he'd be still sitting there. But he'd have a pile of loose-leaf notebook paper, maybe 10, 15 pages, a song on each one.
Yeah, absolutely.
And amazing, amazing fluid writer who would just write stream of consciousness.
I first met Bobby in Hollywood, and I had gone up to GRT Records to try and get some money that was owed to me by the record company, you know, what's new.
Did you get it?
Eventually. It took me 2 weeks to get it. Excuse me, but I did meet Mr. Jamison up there, and now here's a piece from an interview that Jimmy did with Bobby Jamison, where he explains how he met me.
And I met this guy named John Reese, who was sitting in a seat, and I was sitting there. I was very terrified, and I was looking at this guy's ring, and I immediately didn't like him. He had a diamond ring on. I immediately got mad at him. I didn't say anything, but I just didn't like him. And I made a couple of remarks, and they weren't to him. They were made to somebody else. I don't remember who it was. And he responded to them, and we got into a conversation, strangely enough, and struck up
a rapport. So he ended up putting you at ease, right?
Putting me at what?
Ease? Putting you at ease?
Yeah, to some degree.
You thought he was, at first you saw him as another potential shark, right?
Right, and it ended up that he wasn't that.
Mm-hmm.
Not the way I visualized
him. Mm-hmm.
We struck up...
John was there for what? John was there because Rastus had contact with you, too.
Right, Rastus was a group from Cleveland.
Yeah.
And they were going on GRT Records. As a, I guess it's a major release at the time. Mm-hmm. 1970, I think, 71 or something. And he had the master tapes, and he was out in the, out on the West Coast mixing them.
Ah, that's what he was doing.
Yeah, he was mixing down the Rastus master, the first album.
Sound City.
Right, in the valley. And I ended up going out there with him, you know, a lot. Skip back. And I was kind of glad to be doing that because I had been out of it for a while. And mm-hmm. This was my first time back in the studio, just being around the studio. And I, you know, we became friends.
And friends we did become. Bobby and I became great friends and went through many trials and tribulations. But prior to that, Rastus had been in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and building the studio. That's another whole story. We could talk about that for hours. But we had had a lead singer with the band at that point, and his name was Muggsy, right? What was his last name?
Yeah, his real name was Richard D'Amato, former lead singer of The Outsiders.
All right, yeah.
One of the lead singers of The Outsiders.
The strange thing had happened. We had beat our brains out to make this album in Milwaukee, actually in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. And we had, had built a studio called Sonad Studios. We had a lot of people to help us. And Muggsy had been there and sung all the leads and was the lead singer on all the songs. And when we finished the album, damned if Muggsy didn't say he was going to quit and leave the band. What was the reason for that, Jimmy?
It was pretty frustrating. Muggsy, in researching the book that I wrote, Muggsy says in his interview that one of the reasons he left was because of the leadership of the band. He wasn't happy with the leadership, and I won't point any fingers at anybody in particular, but actually, I believe he had something to go to because right after he left us, he began doing commercials in Chicago. And
well, Turtle Pantyhose or something. I remember
Turtles
that.
Never Run.
Turtles Never Run.
So he had a paying gig to go to, and, you know, that's, I guess, understandable.
Yeah.
But, it was a heartbreak for the band.
Yeah, it was a terrible thing because we had just finished mixing the album, and, of course, we had the two-track mixes with Muggsy singing lead.
And a live album.
And a live album as well. And so when I came out to California, I had to overdub a brand new lead singer who was Mark Roman from San Francisco. What was Mark's real name?
Mark's real name was Bill Spirou, and he was a hell of a guy.
He was a hell of a guy.
He was a great guy. He was a former, an interesting, colorful character. He was a former Vietnam veteran.
The Green Beret, right?
He was
or a Black Beret.
He was in I think he was in an elite unit.
Yeah.
And he was decorated for saving the life of some mucky muck in the South Vietnamese Army. And was given this black beret that he used to wear on stage with his army shirt.
Absolutely.
And Mark was a combination of strength and sensitivity, man. He was a good, strong guy, but he was a sensitive, intelligent guy.
Yeah, he was. A very nice man.
Yeah.
And he was Greek.
He was Greek.
Yeah, he could whoop up some good Avgo Lemono.
There you go.
But so this is now this you have to understand. I am in Hollywood, actually in the Valley at Sound City. I'm trying to mix these albums, actually two discs, and I have to overdub a new lead singer on a live album, which is very, very difficult to do because you got leakage from the PA and the monitors and all that stuff. We did it anyway. Mark was just great. He had learned the songs. I think he had like 10 days to learn the songs, and he flew down to L.A., and he came in the studio and worked his butt off and did a remarkable job.
He was great. That was an interesting period, though, in the band's history because we lost Muggsy. We got Mark. Jameson came to the house in Chardon. And then after you guys finished the album, Mark came out to the house in Chardon. And we had a guitar player, and the band's intention, I guess, was to add another guitar to augment the guitar sound to bring a real strong lead player in. And they brought this kid, George Sopich, in.
George Sopich, yeah.
And at that point, it's kind of murky as to why Tony left, but Tony, the original guitar player, left, and we ended up with one guitar player, and that was George. And
yeah.
George was a much stronger lead player than Tony, but Tony was
a great rhythm.
Yeah,
player. Tony. When they were both in the band together, it was a remarkable rhythm sound.
And you know my motto: there's just not enough rhythm.
And never enough rhythm. Never enough rhythm. And so Tony leaves. George comes in. So now there are How many people in the band?
There's a full horn section now because Mark Roman also plays a valve trombone, and he can help fatten up the sound a little bit. There's two tenors. There's valve trombone. The tenor players both double on one of them doubles on alto, one of them doubles on baritone. You had Mark Roman in the band who played valve trombone, and Don Nagy, the bass player,
who played trumpet. Yeah.
So the sound was getting fatter.
How many people though?
There was I'd have to take a head count, but I would say there was probably eight of them at that point.
How many do we have at one point? We have nine.
I think we probably had nine people.
Well, when Danny came in, and he played baritone.
Yeah.
So at one point there was we had possibilities of five horns going at one time.
Yeah, it was an interesting configuration.
It really was, and you know, it was like. So many times that there was no food. I remember there was absolutely no food to feed everybody. It was very, very tough in Cleveland.
And we did what we could. We were supported by at times by some of the benevolent women that hang around the band. well, we call them groupies.
Yeah, it's not a nice term. And there were some very, very wonderful people who helped the band survive.
There were some extremely wonderful people. Yeah. We had a whole cadre of people that came down from Milwaukee that we had met when we were recording the album there, and they were loyal friends as well as fans, and they came down and we had a volleyball net in the front court and we in the front of the house, and we all played volleyball and recorded and wrote songs, and that's what it was all about. And one of the songs I remember was Keep On Pushing.
Keep On Pushing was
a new tune at that time. And that was the era of George, and it brought in a whole new guitar sound. And really, really, George was a powerful player. He was just energetic.
Yeah. And the whole thing was that the band really needed to keep on pushing. Got to keep on pushing. What a track, huh, Jim?
Yeah, great track.
That's something
man.
Else. Yeah, that was
very good. Good showcase of Mark too, yeah. Man. He sang real well on that.
Yeah, I mean he. When he came into the band, he lifted the vocals way, way up. And still, the band was a tough band for any single singer to handle. The band would wear out a single lead singer.
Well, which is why you brought Danny into the picture, too, and they had two lead singers at that time.
Yeah, then Danny came in, and it was something else. I mean, Danny's pretty damn good himself. And, you know, what I'd like to get into, though, at this point is... This band had more bad luck than any band I'd ever worked with in my life. And to this day, I can't figure out. I know that a lot of it was brought on by themselves. And, you know, I'm a great believer in karma. And, though there were some excellent people in the band as far as being human beings, you know, there were some people that were negative. And I think, that helped hold the band back. And, you know, we were talking the other night about the fact that because these guys grew up playing lounges in Cleveland, they really didn't have any idea what the big time was. You know, they were starting to feel it now at this point because they were playing some big festivals. And I think during this time, we had that gig with Ike and Tina Turner, opening for Ike and Tina Turner.
Now, there's another show.
Yeah, that's another one. Right. We could talk about that. But I know all I do know is that there was a 13-week contract involved. And I think it was after, like, the second or third week when Ike says, gotta cut you loose.
Yeah, well, that happens when you sound too good sometimes, too.
Well, it was at Cobo Hall, I remember, in Detroit. Yep. That was the show where Ike cut us loose. And, you know, then the band, I think, had something like 10 or 11 weeks with no gigs because we had planned for that 13-week tour. In order to pay for, you know, pay the bills.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, the band found themselves 2 months out of work, and that made it even harder. And
to say nothing of the problems we had at that gig, where the union came in and was union came in and was going to shut the place down and put two goons at the bottom of the stairs.
Yeah.
Because somebody didn't pay their union dues in Ike's band or something. I think.
Yeah.
And. You know, being a roadie at the time and being the first guy there and, you know, the point man and seeing all the problems first before they erupted, man, it was interesting to see those two big guys not letting me on the stage.
Yeah, I'll say.
To do my job.
Well, we also had another problem in Indianapolis. Remember that?
Clues Hall?
Clues Hall.
Jimmy, how can I forget it?
Jimmy calls me up and says... I think we need the help of the Velvet Whip.
The Velvet Whip. I mean, at this point in my career, man, I go through union contracts and union labor in my sleep. But at that time, I was, you know, I was pretty new to it. And the union guys were eating me alive, man. They were just, they weren't happy because we had long hair. And it was a legit house that did a lot of legit type shows. And they didn't like rock and rollers, man. And, again, I was the tip of the spear. I was always the first one there getting the brunt of it. So I called in reinforcements, man. I called in John.
Yeah, it's, you know, a change of face often will help you change the scene a bit.
I don't think it was a change of face. I think you just had a much more of a way with words than I did at that time.
Well, you were always tired because you were always on the road. And
always driving stuff in, or
absolutely,
or fighting off the bat,
or on a fast or something, you know.
That's another show.
Down, that's how it's been for us, from promises.
think that that song is says a great deal about how things were going with the band. You know, it's amazing. Up, down. It was up, down. It was a damn constant seesaw with this band. Don't you agree, Jim?
It was up, down in the extreme, man. High highs and low lows.
Absolutely. I remember. This is, we're talking now about the second farmhouse in Chardon. The second house in Chardon was a farm.
It was an actual farmhouse with a barn and acreage and the whole
absolutely
number. And it was an actual farmhouse in Chardon, Ohio.
Yeah, and it just happened to be in the snow belt, right? And
it probably got about 60% more snow than the rest of the state.
Absolutely. I remember waking up one morning, couldn't get out of the house because snow had piled up against the doors.
And we had no snow shovels. And do you remember how we dealt with that problem?
Yeah, we, what was it, cardboard boxes, pieces of wood?
Pieces of plywood nailed to 1x2 strips
of
wood.
Somebody figured that out. Probably Mark. Or you.
No, it was probably Don. Don's phrase at that time was, Jim, get my tools.
Get my tools. Don, I remember one morning we had to leave to go on the road for some tour, a small tour or something, and it had dropped to something like 20 below during the night, but it had rained prior to that. So the bus sank into the mud, and then it froze, and the bus was literally stuck in about 8 inches of frozen mud, and we're all out there with anything we could find, pieces of wood, shovels, pickaxes, digging the bus out of this ice. I didn't think we were going to go anywhere that day, to tell you the truth.
Well, we finally called a tow truck, and in the little town of Chardon, the only tow truck that was available was a little tiny tow truck to pull cars out, and he came and backed into the driveway of the farm and hooked up to the bus and started to crank up on the winch, and the whole front end of the tow truck went up in the air, and we're all standing there laughing. I mean, crying on the inside and laughing on the outside, wondering how we're going to get to our gig.
That bus was what, a 1949, what was it? Do you remember what it was?
It was a 1949 flexible bus.
Oh, my God.
And, I mean, there's a whole show in the bus itself. But
absolutely.
You know, I have to cop to the fact that I suggested that they get a bus. I didn't tell them to buy a piece of junk like that.
Yeah. I think it probably had a million airport miles on it to begin with.
They were part of a fleet. They were at one point they were used that type of bus was used as a airport transporter in Chicago, and oddly enough, the buses were made in Loudonville, Ohio. And to this day, that company still knows where every flex bus they ever made is.
In case you don't know what a flexible bus is, it's the one with the scoop on the back. And I think I made two or three runs in that bus, and the heat never worked. And I mean, it was just, remember the night that we were coming back, and everybody, it was so cold on the bus. We went out and bought those little propane gas heaters that says specifically for outdoor use only. We had them in the center aisle of the bus, trying to keep the bus warm. And everybody's saying, wow, we only got 30 more miles to go, we'll be home. And it's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and everybody's exhausted and freezing. And then we get to the house. One, there's no power, and the heat, no fuel oil, so the heater went off. And we had these dogs, right? Remember the dogs, Jim?
Yeah, named after one of the songs that the band did, Nelda Greb. The dog's name was Nelda.
Nelda, right.
And Nelda got loose while we were out at a gig, and had a little romp around the house and left little messages for us everywhere.
Yeah, but first she went and pulled off all the covers from all the beds and dragged them down into the living room. And pooped in just about every room. And that night the entire band slept on the floor in the kitchen with the oven on. Wide open, all the burners and the oven itself.
The oven door open.
And the oven door open, and everybody slept on the floor in the kitchen.
And the following morning, when everybody went to take showers, the water didn't work. And guess who went out to the pump house? It was a farm, don't forget.
Yeah.
Went out to the pump house with a propane torch, a little propane torch, and had to just sit there and massage the pipes with this heat so that the pipes would unfreeze and we'd get hot water again. We'd get water again.
Was that
you?
That
was a common occurrence.
Was that you? Did you do
that? That was me.
That was you.
That was my job because I was up early and I usually discovered the problem.
Did you get scale for that, man?
Like scale? Fish have scales. We got $2 a day to eat on. Imagine that, kiddies.
That's right. Here's your deuce. I'll never forget that. Here's your deuce. $2 a day. This is 1969, 1970, right around in there. $2 didn't go very far. But that's how tough things were for this band. But still, they would not give up. I mean, when this band hit the stage, it was absolutely amazing. I mean, they were scary. They were so powerful and so tight and so together. It was people just could not believe what they were seeing.
It was like a heavy metal horn band. It was so it had so much energy.
Running around all over town.
That's, you know, that song, it always was about to me was, hey, man, we are going to get in your face. And if the horns don't do it, our lead singer will come out and get in your face as well. And he does on that song.
Oh, yeah.
He scats his little butt off,
he
man.
He does, man.
Totally fearless, though.
I love the way he blows the high note at the end and then laughs about it.
And then laughs.
Yeah.
And but the blowing the high note even sounds good.
I know.
You know, it was all in that gravelly voice spirit.
And the amazing thing is I never really got them on tape in the studio like they were live. We should have done everything live.
This is pretty good. This is pretty good stuff, but it doesn't compare to what they were live.
I mean, it's just, and I think we all knew it. You know, it was like, they needed that audience. They needed the participation of the people in front of them to really kick into gear.
Well, don't forget also, too, that they were born into the group. Was born into an era where the gear wasn't that great.
Yeah.
The gear was horrible.
Yeah.
Nowadays, with the gear, just the average gear what we have sitting on the desk here in front of us, I mean, could have made them sound, you made them sound good in the studio, I could have made them sound great live.
Absolutely.
There were no subwoofers,
No.
The microphone selections were horrible, and still they got across, and they sounded great.
You know, we had talked earlier about two lead singers and about Danny Magelin. Danny was a unique person. He came into the band. He came into the band because Muggsy left, or because we decided we needed two lead singers.
Exactly, because no one singer could carry it, and Muggsy had left, and Danny came in, and then Mark came in. And
did Danny come in before Mark? Yeah, he did, didn't he?
I think he did. He came into Milwaukee while we were still recording.
Yeah, in his interview, he said that he was friends with Muggsy for a long time and thought it would be a good thing if he and Muggsy were singing in the same band, and then Muggsy took a powder and left Danny by himself, and so we had to get Mark, and that was how Danny came into the picture. But the amazing thing is that Danny took over singing lead on Sinnin' for You, which was originally hit, we played earlier in the show, by Bakke, Bakke and the Visions from Cleveland. And this is the one that was done in the studio in Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Mike Dracy playing horn solo in the beginning.
Right.
This time we won't step on it. We won't talk over it.
No, but Danny did a crackerjack job of singing this,
man.
Really, he did a great vocal on this.
And who was the song? Andy Klein turned
Keith Hartley?
Keith Hartley Band. Andy Klein.
English band?
Yeah, had turned me on to this song in Cleveland when I first met him there. Andy turned me on to a lot of stuff, a lot of good tunes.
Andy was our good friend who was a promotion man at the time and knew not every inch of his own catalog, but every inch of every catalog from the 50s on. He was a wealth of information.
He was
on
a
music.
Plethora.
A plethora. Yeah, I saw a plethora scurrying across the floor while in the studio here. I didn't want to step on it.
Magdalene, sinning for you. I made myself a dishonest man. I think it was written by Mr. Keith Hartley. As we were saying, that's one of the songs that Mr. Andrew Klein turned me on to, which the band I utilize with the band. So thank you, Andy, very much. A good friend of mine I haven't seen in a long time. Sure miss him. Jim, it's about time we shut this thing down for this show. We'll be back in approximately a week. Stay tuned. Jim will be back with me, right, Jim?
I sure will.
I couldn't do it without him. I mean, we went through some major changes together with this band, and I'm mighty proud to have him here. Jim, I'll see you next week. What do you say?
Yeah.
And we'll get into the death throes of the band and try and get a little bit more in-depth on the players.
I want to get some couch time with my shrink before we go into the death throes of the band.
Okay. All right.
And make some future appointments as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Make sure that no one knows where we live.
Exactly.
Good night, everybody. This is the Blue Power Hour. This is John Reese saying good night and stay tuned for the best music you never heard.